Okay, so to carry straight back on, so I was obviously talking about Tarzan and how licensing really enabled its author, Edgar Rice Burroughs, to make all of this happen, to give contracts to radio writers, to give contracts to film writers, in a way that enabled him also to write elements, but also to oversee different elements to some extent, whether it's on comics, whether it's on film, whether it's on novels or pulp fiction. So, as I said, this started in pulp fiction. So the first Tarzan stories were in these very sort of cheaply produced magazines that weren't really respected particularly. But actually, the reason why I'm pointing to these is, in many ways, the kind of idea of world building, as we've looked at it, or things like Marvel films, all of these characters having a shared world that they kind of inhabit together, came from, to some extent, out of pulp fiction and a lot of what Burroughs was actually doing. So this was around kind of 1910. So he did write Tarzan stories that were published in these magazines, so things like the All Story magazine. But he also wrote other stories as well. So one of which was called The Lands That Time Forgot, that seems very, very different to Tarzan. For one, it's about dinosaurs. So it's clearly sort of prehistorical. It doesn't feature Tarzan. It's a very, very different story. But he had the idea, and soon a number of pulp writers had this idea as well, that if we're going to write all of these stories, what happens if one of them fails? What happens if we spend a month writing a story for a very cheaply sold magazine that nobody buys? We're not going to make much money, you know. So the income that, say, someone like Burroughs would get would be quite problematic. So he was trying to sort of think, how can I effectively reduce the risk? How can I write a story and then not worry about the fact whether anybody buys it? So he came up with this idea of, well, what if it was all the same world? What if my Tarzan stories exist within the same story world as all of my other stories? Whether it makes sense for that to happen or not. So actually he created this thing called the Burroughsian universe. And this was something that was kind of sold and told to audiences. So what it meant was that you would be reading a story called The Land That Time Forgot, which is about dinosaurs. And then for no reason at all, Tarzan would appear halfway through. You don't think you're reading Tarzan, but all of a sudden he appears. And you realize that actually the story world that you're watching here, whilst it seems to be prehistorical, is actually the same jungle that Tarzan is living in. They're all living within the same space. And what that means, commercially speaking, is that Tarzan was very, very popular, very, very successful. He never had to worry about a Tarzan story making money. But he did have to worry about his other ones. So we thought, well, if I can bring Tarzan, the popular character, into a less popular story like The Land That Time Forgot, it means that people will now read The Land That Time Forgot. All of these people reading Tarzan will now also buy this, because Tarzan appears halfway through. So it's telling something new about this particular character in a different story. And actually what this meant is that people started to care more about the thing at the top than any of the stories. People would say, I really like the Burroughsian universe. And it was more about Edgar Rice Burroughs. Now that he's written it, and the story exists within this particular story world, that was what was attracting people to these pulp stories, rather than any particular character or story, more often than not. So I mentioned, in terms of explaining all of this, so that was one aspect in terms of world building. The idea of characters sharing a world, which is now incredibly common, came from pulp fiction. But things like merchandising that I mentioned, this licensing aspect, this commercial aspect, this spreading of a story onto other consumer outlets. Merchandising became very popular around this time, 1920s, 1930s, underpinned by all of these developments that we've been looking. So it's a way to generate publicity, generate interest in Tarzan. So you had toys, you had knives, you had all of these badges, you had jigsaw puzzles, and so on and so forth. And of course, it's exactly the same as these contemporary things that we've been talking about that are now seen as transmedia story worlds, whether it be The Matrix or whether it be something like Doctor Who. It can be traced directly back. Another important factor is radio. Okay, so also radio was emerging around this particular time. It's all kind of interrelated when you start to look at it. And Tarzan was a radio series, and like a number of fictions. So at this point, you know, radio, it's slightly different to how it is now. It's more seen as like a music platform today, or a news platform today. At this time, what was known as radio dramas were incredibly popular. So actually having a story, a fictional story, be told on radio that was split up as episodes in the way that a television series would. So you would tune in on a Monday and listen to a Tarzan story, and then you would tune in again on a Tuesday and you would carry on hearing about the next Tarzan story. And the reason why radio was sort of so important to this sort of culture of transmedia is because by 1930, of course, what's happening is the Great Depression. The whole idea of consumerism is starting to be questioned. Industries are starting to fall flat. Audiences haven't got much money. Everyone is, of course, feeling all of these kind of commercial and social and political pressures. One of the things that radio did as a medium was try to unite the nation, okay? Try to bring American people together. And the reason for that, it was a way to sort of try and reduce any more chaos from happening. So that the industries thought, well, okay, if we reassure people over radio, this mass platform that everybody is listening to, it's a way to reassure people, it's a way to bring people together. So what they did was they tended to focus on types of stories or dramas on radio that they knew were already popular, that were seen as kind of safe in some way, as a way to keep people together. Okay, so this is a quote from kind of NBC, one of the major radio producers, networks of the era. In the face of these severe social upheaval, radio must preserve our population. We must know and honour the same fictional heroes, love the same songs, and realise our common interest together. So having the same types of stories that are already appearing on other media was seen as a really safe strategy in order to keep people consuming in some ways. You know, people were starting to question, well, I can't afford to keep buying books, I can't afford to keep going to the cinema. But if it's a character that you already know and you already love and you feel safe listening to these particular stories, like something like Tarzan that was very, very popular, it was a way to keep people consuming because it was seen as safe. Everybody knows it. Everybody likes it. So let's focus on what we all know and love and share in this together, and everything will be okay. This was kind of the message. So in other words, fewer stories started to be told, but based on the same types of things that were spread across. So now you would have Tarzan everywhere, because Tarzan was seen as safe, a way to unite people together. And this whole idea started to sort of manifest, okay? This whole idea of consumerism, and mass consumerism, and public demand, and people started to want more. People started to actively sort of say, we want more of this, we want more stories, we want more Tarzan, we want more merchandise, we want more radio. Because it was seen as safe, it was seen as popular, it was seen as a way to unite people together. I'm not going to show you this for time, but it's an interesting, there's a trailer for the Tarzan film. They start the quote with actually, we are giving you what you want, you've asked for more Tarzan, it's seen as safe and happy and secure, so we're giving you more of this. So actually transmedia, making you buy a film, was seen as a way to sort of keep people happy. But, of course, this manifested commercially. This meant that someone like Burroughs became a very, very, very rich man, okay? So here is him in a newspaper talking very jokingly about what all of this transmedia storytelling, all of this licensing, has meant for him. And as you can tell, he's talking very clearly about it's made him so much money. You know, back from the days from Second magazine rights and pulp magazines, he's now made all of this money. Perhaps in my radio contract, I'll insist upon the reservation of interplanetary rights. Why not? Radio rights and sound and dialogue rights would have seen as preposterous 20 years ago. So Baum couldn't have done this, which is why he lost money. Burroughs, 20 years later, could do this, and he became very rich through doing it. But one of the problems of doing this was that he kind of he got so absorbed in the money making, he thought, well, I could keep licensing this, I'll keep selling it to film producers, I'll keep selling it to radio writers, I'll keep selling it to comic book writers. And what happened was he sold it so many times to so many different people that in the end he lost that authorship that we've seen to be very, very important. It meant that other writers just made their own versions of Tarzan. It meant that there were not only film versions of Tarzan, but there were competing versions of Tarzan at exactly the same time. People were going to the cinema in the 1930s, and there was an MGM version of Tarzan, and then there was another version produced by RKO that had nothing to do with one another, and they were competing with one another. You know, they were actively trying to lobby with the audience to say, don't go to that Tarzan, go to this Tarzan. So actually it was splitting the audience. Rather than encouraging them to move across, eventually it started to divide the audience because they started to say, well, actually, which version of Tarzan do I go to? Which one is better? How am I supposed to know that which is better? Where's the branding that tells me which version belongs to which? So that it got very, very messy. It started to mean that, say, the MGM producers had certain rights. They could use the word Tarzan, but they couldn't use the word Jane, or they couldn't use certain other characters' names, whereas another motion picture producer could use those names. Certain parts of the story world could appear in one version, but not in another version. So it became very messy, very complicated, very confusing for audiences. So it made a lot of money, but there was a consequence to that. Okay, so that was 1920s, 30s. So the rise of consumerism, the rise of licensing. Made transmediality a financial business based on licensing, but as we saw, there's certain problems. So what happened next? If you get to kind of 1940s US, things start to change again. So yes, there's still a culture of consumerism. Yes, the practice of licensing is still really important for enabling stories to move across platforms. But other things started to take over as being more important than that. So you should be, you know, in terms of context, it's important to remember, radio is still the dominant mass medium. Hollywood is starting to take over, but from 1920s onwards, Hollywood was radio was the mass medium, and Hollywood is starting to now take over. So this is now the era of what becomes known as classical Hollywood filmmaking, when the rise of the big studios start to kind of dominate, start to standardize their products, and become increasingly popular. It's the era when comic books become comic books. So they stop becoming promotional things that exist in newspapers, and they become actual products that people start to buy. And of course, it's the era of World War II. And this is all important. So because it's World War II, certain organisations are set up to actually try and use the media in a way that's going to be beneficial to the war. Okay. So one example is the Office of War Information, or the OWI. This was set up by President Roosevelt, and their job was to liaise with the print industries, the cinema industry, and the radio industry. So up until now, these things are separate. Okay, they don't really talk to one another. There's radio doing radio things, cinema doing cinema, print doing print. Because of the war, it was deemed by the government that we need these media industries to talk to one another, actually engage and collaborate in some way. And this organisation is set up as the sort of the in-between, the company that sort of coordinates the dialogue and the conversation between these industries. The reason why is because it meant if these companies are talking to one another, they can coordinate the messages that are coming from the media. So they can create propaganda through the media in a way that's actually going to be coherent, that's actually going to have a consistent message, and that message is then going to be reinforced across different media, whether it's cinema, whether it's print, or whether it's radio. So something like Rosie the Riveter, for example. So this is propaganda. Of course, this is a fictional character that is being created that has a very strong and clear political agenda at its heart. It's talking, of course, about the role of women during World War II and what the government thought that women should be doing during World War II. And they created a message, or a brand, you might say, and they reinforce that message across different industries. Because the thinking is, quite logically, if you reinforce it across print, cinema, and radio, more people become aware of it, and it will be reinforced. And this is what the government want. They want a clear propaganda message and the media to coordinate itself in a way that enables that message to be coherent. So that's kind of what's going on in the background, okay? But obviously also what's going on is media is continuing to be media. Media is continuing to tell stories and trying to sell products and to try and do creative things that tell really interesting stories. So it's kind of interesting to now trace the connections. How does that influence that? So I'm just going to focus on Superman as an example, okay? So Superman appears in comic books in 1938. So this is just when comics are starting to emerge. Superman is seen as kind of like really the godfather of comic books. He kind of brought it to life, made it popular. So Superman is being Superman. It's not really political at this point. It's just telling stories about Superman. He's saving the planet and so on. So Superman is a comic book, all right? And it's aimed at children. So Superman is a children's character. That was the intention of the character. That's what the writers believed was the point of Superman. So very childish, adolescent stories. However, what's going on, of course, in the background is radio. Okay, radio is seen as incredibly important to the war, right? And at this point, as I mentioned, it's still the most popular in terms of how many people are consuming this on a day-to-day basis. These are some statistics to kind of give you a sense of just how dominant radio actually was around this time. More people spend listening to the radio than they do anything else. So 1940, it's 82. 1944, it rises to almost 89. By 1945, 90% of American families owning a radio, listening to radio on a daily basis. So radio is like, it seems a really important medium. If you want to extend the story, why not do it on radio where more people are listening than anything else? Superman comes through radio, okay? It has a clear sort of transmedia connection, so they would emphasize the comic book version of Superman, even whilst they were promoting the radio version. But what you should know is that the reason why it comes to radio is not as simple as you might think. It's not just the writers of the comic books thought, well, radio is popular, we can license it to some radio writers and tell some more stories and we'll make some more money and we'll be fine. The reason why Superman comes to radio is he gets poached, effectively. The government start to think, okay, we want things like Rosie the Riveter, we want characters that can actually tell a message about the war and tell the type of story that we want and do it across multiple platforms. So they think, well, Superman could work. Superman might be a sort of a children's story, but it's a character who is quite literally dressed in the colours of the nation's flag, who stands for truth, justice and the American way, who is strong, who is powerful, who can be seen as undefeatable, who can, you know, destroy all evil from our planet. Why don't we use Superman? Why don't we make him a sort of an emblem of World War II propaganda and send a message out to all of the other countries in the world that this is America. We are strong. We are undefeatable. What's better as a form of propaganda? So this is why he starts to come to radio. He gets poached from comic books and he becomes a form of transmedia propaganda. So here's some quotes where it was reinforced. They wanted you to know through newspapers that this is now the role of Superman. It's not children's fiction anymore. He's propaganda. Superman is going over there to Germany and Italy and Japan. He's going to clean them up, insists Donenfeld. Donenfeld was the man who's kind of the creator or the owner, at least initially, of Superman. I have hopes it'll bring Hitler and Mussolini to this country, set them down in New York's East Side. It'll sweep the world for democracy. So this was the message. Superman is now transmedia propaganda. And what this meant, because he was poached from radio, because now print and radio are now talking to one another through the government, through organisations like the Office of War Information, it meant that the writers behind it could now cross over between these industries and actually write stories across platforms. Because the government said that this was important, they want a coherent story that's consistent in a way that's going to reinforce these kind of propaganda messages. So they actually asked for the comic book writers to move over into radio and to write the radio stories. So you've got various stories that were what we consider transmedia storytelling. You had characters such as Jimmy Olsen, who was a secondary character from the Superman world. You first actually get introduced to that character on radio. that's where you first hear him. But it's just an introduction. And then you go over into a comic book and you then learn for the first time how Jimmy Olsen met Superman. So you see the introduction of that relationship develop. Then you go back over to radio and you see the next stages of that particular relationship. And that can only happen through the government coordinating this and allowing writers to cross different media platforms, in this case print and radio. But it doesn't just stop with print and radio. Hollywood, as I mentioned, is now huge. Hollywood has really sort of become, if not the most popular, certainly the second most popular medium. So it has a role to play in the war. So the government start to get involved in Hollywood filmmaking and dictate what Hollywood studios can and cannot make during this particular era. So because of that, the most popular genre becomes war films, unsurprisingly. They specifically said, if you want to keep running as an industry, you have to make so many war films. And they have to be very patriotic. They can't be sort of down and dark and despair in any way. They have to be hopeful, optimistic, and show Americans as winning the war. Americans as kind of the saviors, if you like. So what this means is that Superman gets poached again. So Superman now gets taken by the government and they say, well, why don't we make some films? He's now a propaganda symbol. Why don't we put him in cinema as well? So he then became the source of very, very expensive short films made by Paramount. Paramount, of course, one of the giant industries of this particular era. Quite rare for what was seen as a children's story to be given such a big budget at this point. Reason is, he's propaganda. He's seen as a way to promote a message about American values, truth, justice in the American way. We can make expensive films of him winning the war, of him saving the country. Dressed, of course, as I said, in the colours of our flag. And this will be fantastic propaganda for our country. And again, I should have mentioned, same writer. So because they want a consistent message being told, same comic writer, or at least a number of the same comic writers, now moving over into Hollywood. Previously, no comic writers were ever seen anywhere near Hollywood. Because of the war, they were allowed to. And what this meant is that certain changes actually started to happen in terms of who the character was, in terms of building the character across media. So you may or not, this is my trivia moment, okay? You may or may not be aware that originally Superman couldn't fly. So when he was in comics, couldn't fly. He could leap, hence the slogan, leap tall buildings in a single bound, which you might have heard of. The reason why that was the slogan is because he couldn't fly. He just leapt over things, and that was it. He didn't fly until he appeared in these films. This was the first time he started to fly. And the reason why he starts to fly was not because the writers thought this would be a really fun, creative thing to do. It's because the government told them to do it. So, the Office of War Information, this is kind of a sort of newspaper thing kind of talking about it. Parents who might not be keeping up with Superman may not be aware of the high moral tone pervading his exploits, or aware of a serious-minded government committee led by the OWI with educators and psychologists instruct on the editorial policy. So the decision to make the character fly come from that particular committee. Reason being, they thought, well, okay, Superman is patriotic, he's strong, he's a really nice hero figure to convey the idea of America winning the war, but wouldn't it be even better if he could fly, if he could literally fly over to these different countries faster than a speeding bullet and just solve all of these problems that we might be facing? That would make him seem that much more unbeatable. So that was the reason he developed as a flying character. So this is character building across different platforms. But of course, it's informed in a very, very different way. And inevitably, what this meant is that now we're talking about Superman. And again, this isn't representative. Lots of sort of characters were doing similar things if they were seen as important to the war. So lots of superheroes were similarly being used as war propaganda. Things like Rosie the Riveter, all these kinds of things. Inevitably, it meant that these types of characters, these types of stories, started to be talked about in the press, in newspapers, by audiences, in ways that we would now think of as transmediality. They don't use the word transmedia because that is a new word that kind of emerged, as we saw yesterday in 1991. But the ethos, the idea behind it, was being talked about. So the idea of a market tie-up. seems to be another way of saying a product, a part of a story that's connected to something else, that is tied together. It's the same idea of transmedia, but just a different word. So market tie-ups. Superman's radio serial opens up an opportunity for theatres playing Superman shorts who can try for promo announcements at break time time. So when people went to the cinema and they saw these Superman films, after the film, they then saw an advertisement for the Superman radio show, so they were then pushed across to that particular platform to find out what happened next, to see the next adventure. And that only could have happened because of the government making it happen, insisting that it actually happened. Radio's popular cartoon series will be used in connection with the radio program, as well as with the mags and newspapers. So it's journalists kind of just talking about this as if it's normal. Comics, radio, films, all being connected together, all being tied together in a way that we would now just talk about as transmedia storytelling, but in a way that Pay Henry Jenkins or Marcia Kinder has somehow suggested this didn't happen in the past. But clearly it did. It's used a different term, a different word, but it was always being talked about. It was always being done. And in that sense, again, I keep pointing to sort of comparative examples. Is it really any different? That is exactly the same as the Osmopolitan, is it not? The Oz newspaper that I showed you at the start that had interviews with the Scarecrow rather than interviews with Harvey Dent. This one was digital and put online. The Oz one was a piece of paper handed out in the street. But other than that, it's the same practice. It's exactly the same strategy that's being informed by different things. This is informed by the rise of the internet, whereas Oz was informed by the rise of mass production, industrialization, the rise of advertising. So different developments ultimately leading to exactly the same results, transmedia storytelling. So just to quickly sort of sum up, just in case it's not abundantly clear, transmedia is therefore, of course, not necessarily the product of contemporary convergence cultures. I don't think all those people who say that are wrong, but what I do say is that convergence culture makes transmedia more prominent. It seems to have made it more immediately visible to us. The internet makes media so shareable and so pervasive into our lives that it makes this idea of telling a story across platforms so much more visible and also so much easier to do that I think it makes sense why it's only now people actually start to talk about this idea of transmedia. But it was always there. It may have been less visible. It may have been less financially viable. There may have been more problems associated with it. It may have been the result of things like propaganda and war films and the government. But it was still happening. And these particular things, as we've seen, at different phases, seem to be very important. Industrialization originally, making more of something on a mass scale. Consumer culture, encouraging audiences to keep buying more and more and to move across more and more platforms. And even, of all things, I think the most surprising one is regulation. The role of the government. In some ways, I think we can understand that as like authorship. Okay, so you could say the author of transmedia Superman in the 1940s was the government, because they were the ones at the top. They were the ones overseeing everything and dictating that all of these writers moved across platforms, that all of these stories were told across different platforms. So it's very different, operates in a very different way. But again, character building, world building, authorship seems to be very, very important. The thing that I do kind of very briefly want to point to, because it's going to be important in lecture six, is the idea that it's not just about commercial. So far I've been pointing towards brand and promotion and advertising and making money. We can think about transmediality as another function. The idea, maybe it's a social thing, like with the radio, it's a way to bring people together to make us feel safe in the stories that are being told. Maybe it's a political function, like propaganda, telling a certain message across platforms for a very, very particular political motivation. And I'm going to pick up on that, as I said, in lecture six. Okay? Thank you very much. I'll leave it there.